Welcome to this podcast presented by Steady Hand Investment Funds. I'm Tom Bradley, and I'm here today to introduce you to another one of our fund managers. During our process to find someone to manage our global equity fund, we looked at many candidates, but the one that came out on top was a firm from Scotland called Edinburgh Partners. They were experienced, passionate about what they were doing, and their approach fit Steady Hand's investment philosophy like a glove. Today I have with me, via telephone, Sandy Nairn, the founder and president of Edinburgh Partners. We're going to talk about Sandy's background, as well as some of his and other investment managers. We'll hear about what led them to start Edinburgh Partners in 2003, and we'll drill into the firm's approach and investment philosophy. Sandy, we're delighted to have you here today. Welcome.
Thanks, Tom. It's a pleasure.
Now, Edinburgh Partners is only 4 years old, but certainly we at Steady Hand were comfortable. We were hiring some of the most experienced managers in the business. To give our listeners some understanding of why I say that, why don't you start maybe with your background and prior to founding the firm?
Sure. No, I'd be glad to. My background is I started an investment in the early mid-80s with an investment firm in Scotland. In 1990, I joined Templeton, again, based in Scotland, and then laterally, in 2000, I was working for Templeton in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. The team that we have here are individuals that I have worked with over that 20-plus year period. We know each other very well philosophically. We think the same way. We think about the things that are important in the same way. So although the firm itself looks like it's only 4 years old, the team has been working together for a much longer period than that.
Well, maybe just while we're on the team, can you give us a little insight as to sort of how you assembled them? And I don't know how you kind of pieced it together, because certainly when I visited you in Edinburgh, been very impressed with the talent you have there.
Yes, I mean, in a sense, I suppose in all these things, there's a degree of chance. In 2000, I was approached to join a large investment company in Scotland that had pretty bad performance with an attempt, an agenda to try and turn that around. And clearly, in order to try and do such a thing, you have to introduce a proper approach to investment, but most importantly, you have to bring in good people. And so the team that is here are largely those people who I've known for a very long period, individually and collectively, people with extremely strong track records, who all came together to try and fix some of the things that needed fixed in that investment company. Now, we got a long way towards doing that, but eventually realized that for us as individuals, we wanted to spend our time picking stocks and running money, and in very large organizations, that can sometimes be difficult. So the team that came together for that purpose ended up as the team that constitutes Edinburgh Partners.
Now, you mentioned Templeton, and just as a bit of an aside, but I've got sitting on my desk a tome that you've written called Engines That Move Markets, Technology Investing from Railroads to the Internet and Beyond. And this clearly must have been quite a project. Where the heck did you find time to do that? Didn't they work you very hard as head of global research at Templeton?
They did, and I have to say sometimes I wonder myself. I mean, basically I worked every night, every weekend, and every holiday for 18 months on it. Not something I would want to remind my wife of, because she still believes I owe her for some considerable time for disappearing. I think the background to that book, which unfortunately has an awful title. The title I wanted for it was, to use John Templeton's phrase, this time is different, the four most expensive words in the investing language. But the publisher said that it has to be picked up on internet search engines, and therefore there's certain keywords have to be in the title. So you can gather how they got to such a long title. The background to the book is, at the time I was living in Florida where all the madness was going on in the internet, and the funds that I was managing had no exposure to this because the stocks looked obviously expensive. But the longer it goes on, the greater the danger you doubt yourself. And when you doubt yourself, there's only one thing you can do is go back and recheck. And everybody at the time was saying, well, you remember the dreadful phrases, new paradigm, post-industrial revolution. It was all, you kind of look back and your eyebrows go up. But what I did was just go back at previous examples of technological change of a similar magnitude and see what happened at the time, what would you have known, and what the outcome was. And it was a way of me retaining my sanity when my relative performance didn't look good, and reassuring myself that I was doing the right thing.
Well, it's as I say, I'm not very far into it, but I find it very readable, and I can tell our readers that it was available to me in Canada on from business books on business, which you can access online or by telephone. Now, not to belabor the book, but I think it also maybe feeds into your background a little. The book has a foreword by John Templeton, and who you worked with at Templeton, obviously, for a number of years. Out of interest, what part did Sir John play in development as a view as a money manager?
I think it's widely recognized that John Templeton's an investing genius. I'm not sure it's, in my opinion, quite as widely recognized as to why he's an investment genius. And I think the answer for me was when I first met him, I'd read every theory about investing there was to read. I'd looked at all the textbooks. I'd done all that I could to try and improve myself as an investor. What Sir John has always had is absolute clarity about what it is he's trying to achieve. And for me, that clarity put everything into focus. And where that clarity comes in is, when you speak to John Templeton, he tells you the answer, just most people don't tend to listen to it. They expect, I guess it's like a golfer, they expect a magic pill that makes them better. You expect the magic answer. What he tells you is buy cheap stocks. The definition of cheap stocks falls out of looking at companies over the right time horizon.
Mm-hmm.
And life is really as simple. That's all you're trying to achieve. The question is, A, have you the ability to make the forecasts on the companies? And many people have. That's one sticking point, but it's not the major one. The major sticking point is, are you actually willing to implement it? So during the TMT bubble, since we just talked about it, the pressure to own, for example, Cisco and Amazon was absolutely immense because they were the only stocks going up. If you didn't own them, your short-term performance was poor. You came under intense pressure from clients and sales forces. So many people took the approach that said, well, it doesn't matter if I'm right or wrong. I won't have a client. I won't have a job if I don't buy them. And they rationalized it that way to buy them. What John Templeton would have told you was the only way to make money for clients is to buy cheap stocks. Why are you buying expensive ones? And so one of the abiding rules we have here is never, ever buy a security for a client portfolio you would not buy yourself, and therefore it must be on an absolute basis cheap. And if you learn any lesson from John Templeton, that's the first one you should learn.
Hmm. Well, that's, I'm sure you consider yourself lucky to have worked with him for the years you did. I think that's a good segue, Sandy, into sort of what the core philosophy is of Edinburgh Partners. So maybe you could take us through or continue on that stream and take us through the basics of how you and your team approach building portfolios and making your clients money.
Sure. No, I'd be glad to. I mean, I think, picking up on the last point, there's very clear persuasive evidence that if you can get anywhere close to forecasting long-term profits of a company, then you know the return you're going to make from owning it through capital appreciation and dividends. It's a relationship that has never really changed. So what that means is that your focus has to be on the forecasting element, and that takes you into a whole range of things as to why a firm is set up the way ours is set up, so that we have only experienced people picking stocks. You know, many firms have analysis of companies being done by junior people, they migrate away from it. That's absolutely the wrong way around. It should be only experienced people. In terms of the actual day job of analyzing companies, again, you know, in abstract, it's pretty straightforward. You can pick, you know, any company you like, and all you're trying to do is figure out what's going to happen to the various segments of its business. So depending which industry it's in, you'll be looking at whether there's growth in that industry, what the barriers to entry are, how the company management is doing, what the cash flow is, and you build it up piece by piece. What you often find is that there are companies that collectively are out of favor. So 3 years ago, we were finding a large number of Japanese companies were very cheap. And the reason was, in the short run, everybody hated Japan, so we were buying high-end retailers like Takashimaya. The most notable example, I think, was Mizuho Bank. And just to give you, you know, a flavor of Mizuho Bank at the time, it had almost the same total assets as Citigroup. It was on a market capitalization about one-seventh of Citigroup's. So, you know, basically, yes, there were lots of things you didn't know about bad debt experiences, but you were having to expect six-sevenths of the value of the business to disappear to justify not owning it relative to Citigroup. And you do get anomalies of that magnitude appearing on occasions, and they're frequently clustered together, just as you get anomalies of very expensive companies clustering together as people get overly enthusiastic and lose track of timescales. So, you know, over the past 3 or 4 years, we've gone from finding a lot in Japan, a lot in middle-sized companies in Europe where margin expansion was coming, emerging markets. It's moved away from those now, and most people would not agree with us, but actually large companies in the U.S. are relatively attractive.
Now, speaking to that, Sandy, I think one of the things at Steady Hand that we've tried to do is not put undue constraints on our managers. We have to be a responsible fund company, but where we can, we've allowed our managers to have freedom to take the portfolio where it finds value. And one of the things we were impressed with your firm impressed us was the fact that you weren't afraid to use that freedom, and certainly past actions would speak to that, just as you've spoken about owning a lot of Japan stocks. How is it that, and it seems to me you were telling me when I was over in Edinburgh, you'd at one point owned almost no U.S. stocks, which for a global equity fund is obviously very unusual. Have I got that right? And I guess the question related to that is how are you able to act so decisively? And I think of companies agonizing over a 1% change in a stock weighting or a sector weighting, but your team seems to be able to move and act on its convictions.
It actually, I think, goes back to the earlier question about what did you learn from John Templeton, the buy cheap stocks element. There are lots of people in the market, I think, have missed the point about what risk is. The majority of the marketplace defines risk relative to market indices, so how big a company is rather than what its valuation is. And what John Templeton has always said is buy cheap stocks. So if you find a stock that's cheap, but it's not one of the biggest stocks in the index, don't worry about not owning it. That is not an issue. Ultimately, all your clients are concerned about is, are you making money? And as long as you have the right time horizon, and that's the critical element, then you should be able to buy cheap stocks and hold them. I mean, that's the most important conviction we have, is that over five-year periods, undervaluation gets corrected. You just have to have the courage to hold it. And that's your own courage, but it's also ensuring that the education for clients is consistent with that. It's not about quarterly performance. It's not about quarterly relative performance. It's about, have you analyzed the company correctly? Are you owning cheap enough stocks? And if you do, it will be rewarded. There will be periods when what you do looks very strange. And nothing in the U.S. was one of those periods. And we had a number of people tell us our tracking error was, you know, out of the ballpark. All we said to them is, we have looked at many, many, many U.S. companies, and they're simply not cheap enough, and we're not owning expensive stocks to get a tracking error down. our view of risk is owning an expensive stock. And that's what we build into portfolios. We're trying to build in where we might get our forecast wrong, because ultimately that's what will affect performance. But you have to be able to ignore short-term relative performance to be able to do that. And markets often don't allow you to do that. And that's why when we talked before about steady hands philosophy is why we were comfortable doing something like this. Most retail investors have sold to them every day the portfolio that just went up, as opposed to the portfolio that's the cheapest.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You know, we describe our equity funds as being absolute return oriented. In other words, our managers, to what you're speaking about, are not caught up in trying to mirror the index or follow the competition. They're totally focused on making clients money, or in your case, as you express it, buying cheap stocks. But in one of our previous conversations, you, I would have to say, ever so diplomatically suggested that we had our wording incorrect, and that certainly as far as you guys were concerned, that you felt that the focus was on absolute valuation as opposed to absolute return. We've sort of talked all around that, but can you just give me a little flavor of what you meant by that?
No, I'd be glad to. I mean, the danger I have with when the term absolute valuation is used is how it's interpreted by an investor. Because if an investor interprets it that over no period will the value of their portfolio fall, then that's very dangerous, because the best times to be buying cheap stocks is when the share prices are falling. And if share prices fall from a position where they start at fair value, then the value of the portfolio will fall with it. The protection that absolute valuation gives you is a protection that relates to the five-year period, not to individual quarters or even individual years. And I think it's, you know, in a sense, it's a contract that we have with investors, and it's incumbent on us to explain what we're doing and what the investor should expect, both good and bad, over different time periods. And the danger with absolute valuation is the investor believes that at no point will the value of their portfolio ever fall. And the only way to achieve that is with extensive hedging, which takes away all the upside, and they actually end up with normally quite poor returns. You know, you get the returns in equities because you're willing to wait the right time horizon, and that's what gives you the absolute return intent and delivery, and it's absolute valuation that gets you there. But if you focus on, you know, if the markets fell 20% in the next quarter, that could happen. That'll provide opportunities, but over the five-year view, that's where you get a chance to exploit them.
Sandy, on this, our first podcast with Edinburgh Partners, we don't have time to delve into the current strategy of the Steady Hand Global Equity Fund, but maybe we could finish up with a few general questions that have come to us from our clients and prospective clients about your firm and about the fund. One of them certainly is, how can they cover the world from one location in Edinburgh, Scotland?
Yeah, it's a good question. An unreasonable defense is to go back and say, if I take the John Templeton example, he created some of the best returns ever recorded in the mutual fund industry in the 60s and 70s, living in the Bahamas on his own without the benefit of telecommunications. Now we have, allegedly, the internet has opened up the whole world in terms of information flow. I think the answer is, analyzing companies is all about your knowledge of their financials, what the companies are doing. That there are many, many sources of that information, as well as going to visit the companies. Your location is not the issue. The issue is the quality of the people doing the work and their willingness to spend their time investigating all that needs to be investigated. So actually, maybe I'd give another John Templeton quote. He was asked on one occasion what helped him most with his investment decision-making. And I'm slightly paraphrasing because I can't remember the exact quote, but he said every mile he moved away from New York.
Well, we're out on the West Coast in Vancouver, so we're not as far away from New York as you are, but or London perhaps. But now you run, you know, pretty concentrated portfolios, and we've talked about you not being afraid to act on your convictions. But a vast majority of the firms we screened and looking for a global equity manager own hundreds of stocks. Is it because you only find a certain number of cheap stocks, or is there a particular reason you run more concentrated portfolios?
Yeah, I think there's two elements to it. One, I mean, our approach is to say we must own at least the minimum number of stocks to gain you the benefits of diversification. And the studies would suggest, and I've seen different studies, some as low as the low 20s in terms of number of stocks, but 30, 40 stocks gets you the vast majority of the benefits of diversification. The question then turns around to say, well, how much benefit is there owning a big long tail of stocks? And if you look at many of the funds that own a big long tail, it's because of their size or the size of the organization's funds. They simply, liquidity prevents them owning a smaller number of stocks because of the aggregate ownership. So I think that's the first reason. It's not so much that that it's an unusual thing to do, it's that many firms are unable to do it because of the size of the assets they're trying to run. I think the second reason is that you get, well, there's two parts to the second reason. You get a long tail of funds, a long tail of holdings. Some people are unwilling to admit mistakes, and they leave small holdings in the hope that the share prices go back up. If you make a mistake, you sell the stock, and a mistake is simply defined as you're changing your long-term earnings estimate and it's gone from being cheap to expensive. And I think the second reason is we look at the stocks against each other to find the cheapest ones. Many global managers split the world up into regions, and then each region tries to beat the index. And arithmetically, you end up with a couple hundred stocks by doing it that way, because everybody wants 30 or 40 stocks against their piece of the portfolio. We're simply trying to find the 30, 40 cheapest ones, get the risk-reward balance right. With the benefits of diversification, we don't need any more stocks. If we don't need any more, why potentially dilute the returns?
Now, that begs another question that we've been asked with regard to a number of our funds. You know, you and your team have a terrific track record and reputation, and have garnered attention in the pension world in Europe. I think it's mostly pensions, and I know the firm's growing nicely. Is there a point where you have to change your approach to deal with more assets under management, and would you close your doors to new business at some point?
The answer to the first piece of the question is we won't change our approach because we don't know how to, which leads you to the second part of your question. Yes, we have to close our doors. I mean, again, it goes back to a point I tried to make earlier about never buy a stock for a client you wouldn't buy for yourself. And I think the answer to the second part is never manage a portfolio in a way different from how you do it for yourself. And if the assets become too large and you start diminishing potential returns, you've reached as far as you can go. And I think we're all comfortable with that. I mean, one of the reasons we set this up is we'd all worked in large organizations and become frustrated about a whole range of things. Not least the amount of time that was spent away from investment matters, but also your ability to build portfolios because of the sheer weight of money you were trying to manage. So the whole purpose of Edinburgh Partners is to avoid that. And if we're fortunate enough to get to a position where those dangers loom, then we have no doubt we'll shut the doors.
Okay, good. We're constantly asked by Canadians, clients and prospects about, you know, where global investing should fit into a portfolio. And with our dollar going through the roof and domestic returns having been so good, it's certainly a timely question to ask. Is there any lessons you've gleaned from watching investors in the UK or other European countries, or your time in the US for that matter, that could help Canadians address this issue?
I'm not sure how helpful it'll be, but I think most of what I would see is that almost all investors have too much exposure to their domestic marketplace. And the reason I would say that is you've got a whole world of stocks out there. Most people's domestic marketplace is only a small proportion of it. They typically own many multiples of the proportion in their portfolios. And that effectively takes away access to some of the opportunities elsewhere. There was a period, if I look at the UK as an example, for 6 or 7 years, the UK market outperformed the world index. an investor said, why ever would you invest globally? And then for the next 10 years, the opposite was the case. So diversification is important. I mean, clearly, the Canadian market is a very skewed market to a number of factors that have been incredibly positive. That's fantastic for investors. If it were me, I would be trying to diversify some of that away and take it to another level with securities from outside Canada. But you need to strain what I say, because I clearly have a vested interest in this.
We'll recognize you have an axe to grind. Do you ever hedge currencies?
We can hedge currencies. We have in the past hedged currencies. Our experience has been that unless a currency is very strongly distended from its valuation, it follows effectively a random path. We don't see any currencies at the moment that are so distended from their valuation that it's appropriate to hedge them. We do not agree with the view that the dollar is expensive, the US dollar. So we are currently unhedged, remembering, of course, that in many of the companies' cases, they are global in their outlook, and there's a natural hedge sitting within the companies anyway.
Right, yeah. Well, Sandy, this has been fabulous. You've given our listeners a lot of insight into what Edinburgh Partners is all about, and I really thank you for taking the time.
My pleasure.
This has been a podcast from Steady Hand Investment Funds. I encourage you to give a listen to future podcasts, as well as the ones we currently have listed on our website, steadyhand.com.